12th century man of letters. To officially define the narratives he published in the name of history as a reliable academic source would bring those aforementioned modern historians out in hives. So what was he, this Geoffrey of Monmouth? A storyteller? Geoffrey's fame, or rather infamy, as a fantastical faker of ancient history was already alluded to in the introduction to the first volume of Histories of Britain. His near thousand-year-old publication does pay some degree of lip service to his predecessors as British narrators, Gildas and Bede, distant figures of antiquity in Geoffrey's time though they were. Though oddly not so much the Welsh historian Nennius, though his work was clearly a crucial ingredient in Geoffrey's soup of sources. His name only appears as that of the brother of Cassivellaunus, slain by Caesar in Book 4. As he lays out his stall, Geoffrey of course makes sure to beg the forgiveness of the reader or audience for his shortcomings as a historian, just as those other British historians tended to protest their modesty as part of their own introductions centuries earlier. But rarely has such a plea for lowered critical faculties seemed so essential. My previous introduction also made mention of the most important detail in the whole of Geoffrey's narrative, which the writer was absolutely certain to stress on the very first page, that he was working from a number of sources, but above all was indebted to a very ancient book in the British tongue, which, in a continued regular story and elegant style, related the actions of a whole host of British rulers stretching back to the Giants of Albion and the Battle of Troy. What is essential about his mention of this book, apart from the clear inference that he understood Welsh well enough to translate it into Latin, is Geoffrey's insistence that he was given the crucial work by one Walter, Archdeacon of Oxford. Some claim this to have been the medieval satirist Walter Map, but Map surely could not have been born when Geoffrey sat down to start this work. Whoever this fellow cleric was, this mention is our one spot of evidence of such an Oxonian scholar's existence, though extra strength for Geoffrey's claim can also be gleaned from the patronage of Henry I's bastard son Robert, Earl of Gloucester, to whom the work was addressed and dedicated. This Norman Robert was one of the most powerful men in a lethally divided Britain, and the key supporter of his half-sister Matilda. Despite being based in the west of England, the Earl held Welsh lands and was known to have commissioned a translation into Latin of a whole raft of texts in the Welsh language at this time. Of course, this one crucial supposed source material, mentioned by Geoffrey at the start and end of his opus, is long lost, which shouldn't really be that surprising after over 900 years. Given the centuries of fire and destruction between then and now, we should rightly celebrate the survival of the few books from this period which have remained around long enough to be translated into English, digitised, and recorded as audiobooks. Naturally, the most cynical modern historians happily assume that Geoffrey's crucial lost source never even existed in the first place. But given all this convergence of circumstantial evidence, it seems logically quite fanciful to depict Geoffrey as a fantasist and to positively dismiss this lost British history book as a lie. Why would any Christian scholar drag a fellow man of God into his fictional ravings, let alone one of the most powerful men in the country? Calumny on that count could have brought disaster down upon our Geoffrey in this world, even if the recording of egregious historical lies wasn't already going to cause him problems in the afterlife. To the medieval mind, posthumous justice and eternal suffering were the most real things in existence, and committing any kind of sin was not something anyone could easily brush off. Perhaps we have a simplistic view of the concepts of right and wrong as held by the medieval devout. Broad acceptance that a box of bird bones could be a holy relic, scraps from the New Testament table, seems forgivably gullible enough. But somewhere along the line, usually, somebody knowingly created the lie. The convenient graves of King Arthur and Guinevere planted by the brothers of Glastonbury Abbey a few decades after Geoffrey's death, the saintly fingers and foreskins that could reduce whole congregations to worshipful jelly, who, in those times, would have dared to flirt with an eternity of infinite suffering to claim such things were the gospel truth? And so it is with Geoffrey's outlandish history book, which, in terms of British cultural value, puts so much